This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome to the Big Picture. This is our first real Big Picture of the year on the Financial Sense News Hour. We actually broke with tradition. This has been a year of surprises. The tradition that we broke with is our first program of the year is normally a look at what the consensus forecast is for the coming year. But both Jim and I were desperately ill. Jim had laryngitis. He couldn't talk, and which is, you know, I consider that almost a blessing at a point there. But I didn't say that, you know. And I was so down with the flu, I could barely move. So that was our break with tradition. But the year has been a year of surprises. Now, remember, what we do at the beginning of each year is the first show is a consensus forecast of what the various people are saying out there. And that's what we're going to do now. This will be the official first show of the year. And then the next week, we make our own predictions. But it was a year of surprises, and the surprises just took a lot of people short. From Brexit, the Brexit vote, the decision of Great Britain to leave the European Union, to the election of Donald Trump, to the, I would say, the implosion of confidence in the media, which has been recognized here that I never thought I would ever see, even though we have known for years and years and years, Jim, that the mainline media were very biased in their reporting and you weren't getting complete stories. All of a sudden, it's become obvious to many, many, many people. Now, as far as the market, stock prices ended up with double-digit gains, confounding all of the experts. As a matter of fact, Byron Wien wrote that he was looking really good, one of his best forecasts ever, until Donald Trump was elected president and everything changed. As a matter of fact, the Wall Street Journal just had an article that George Soros bet against the stock market $1 billion and lost it after the election of Donald Trump. He thought everything was going to go to heck. It did not. As a matter of fact, the Dow was up to a record. The S&P up to a record, the NASDAQ up to a record, and the Russell 2000 up to a record. You must admit, these are historic times, Jim.
Yeah, you know, actually, John, overall, it was a good year for all asset classes. The total return for the stock market, you just mentioned they were up, but total return includes dividends because Dow and S&P stocks and even some NASDAQ stocks pay a dividend, but the total return for the Dow Industrials was 16.5%. Boy, was that a far cry from forecast at the beginning of the year. We had the S&P that was up 11.95%. The NASDAQ was up almost 9%. And the stellar performer was the Russell 2000. Those are small cap stocks. The Russell was up over 21%. Now, as good as that sounds, there were even better returns on the commodity side. The price of oil was up 45%. And we'll talk about that next week. Was up 45% in 2016. Gold prices were up 8%. The dollar index was up about 2.8%. The 10-year treasury note really didn't do much of anything last year, despite the big run-up from its lows during the summer. Remember, it got down to 1.3, and then we went up to 2.6 before it started backing off. But really, it ended up the year at 2.44%, not too much further than where it began at the beginning of the year. And the CRB index of commodities was up close to 13%. So, John, everywhere you looked, it was one of those years that just about every asset class really took off. Commodities took off in the second quarter or towards the end of the first quarter after bottoming in February. And then we had various things that were going to happen. Remember, the stock market was supposed to crash with Brexit. Well, it did for 2 days, and then we had one of the best summer rallies. Then the market kind of holds back, and then Trump gets elected. And contrary to crashing, as it did on election eve, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went on to basically reach a new record.
Well, so given the sharp run-up, what really did well in the fourth quarter of the year? Because if we look at it, that's where most of the returns came from.
As Frank Holmes talked about in our first hour, it was small and mid-cap stocks that did the best. And that reflects, once again, the Russell and the NASDAQ doing well. things that did not do well. Well, some of the larger international funds, especially what was going on in emerging markets, because it was thought the Trump presidency would be anti-trade. So emerging market funds did not do well. Things that did well in terms of sector funds were financial services, because the possibility of Trump deregulation, a steeper yield curve, and actually natural resources did pretty well. On the world market funds, you know, it's just a matter of who lost the least in the fourth quarter. And then, you had balance funds that sort of did mediocre because bonds were not doing well after the election. So a lot of those balance funds that have maybe 40, 50% bonds in them, remember, we had a sharp run-up in the 10-year Treasury note right after the Trump election. So a lot of the balance funds did not do as well. You know, what was really surprising when you look at 2016 is outside the predictions for the market, which were thrown off kilter. In fact, Byron Wien was interviewed in Barron's last week, and he said it was one of the best 10 forecasts that he's ever given in his life until Donald Trump got elected. And then, of course, everybody's forecast was thrown off, including George Soros, who lost $1 billion between the election and the end of the year. So, I mean, that goes to show you how just kind of skewed everything was towards that final 6 weeks of the year. And it was also, as you mentioned, John, it was one of those years where forecasters had profound missteps, everything from the prediction of what was going to happen with Brexit to actually the presidential election. But, you know, despite that, it was just one of those things when everybody widely believes that this is so obvious, this is what's going to happen. Well, guess what? It was a year full of surprises, and the opposite happened, which is, I think, could happen very well this year.
You know, I think what would be fitting in what we're doing here is to put into perspective what happened in 2016 now, because all of the effects of that are carrying over into 2017. And the way we experience it, which is the way you experience most history, is just a series of incidents, boom, 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 boom. And then only in retrospect do you begin to establish a pattern. So let's look at that.
Okay. Well, you know, actually 2016, outside a few areas, and especially when it comes to GDP, it was a year that most forecasters, if you look at some of the economic numbers, they were actually pretty close. I mean, for example, unemployment was forecast to come in at the end of the year at 4.7%. Actual unemployment came in at 4.6%. So pretty good job there. Non-farm payrolls, the forecast was 191,000. The actual average was 188,000. I mean, that's pretty accurate. Inflation was forecast at 2.2%. Well, they fell short of that almost by a half a percentage point, 1.7%, which was one of the things the Fed talked about in 2016, is that they really couldn't, you know, inflation wasn't hitting their targets. Now, here's a couple places that they really got wrong. Now, remember, heading into 2016, the Fed raised interest rates in December 2015 for the first time in 9 years. And so it was widely anticipated by the Fed's own forecast in December of 2015. They said, we're going to raise four times. Forecasters predicted three interest rate hikes. We actually only got one. So they really missed that one by a wide mark. Crude oil prices, the average price was predicted to be $43.46. We actually came in at $52.65. And you think about it, where we were in the first 6 weeks of 2016, when the price of oil and all commodities fell, oil got down to $26 a barrel. It would be hard to believe by the end of the year, prices would be up that much. Housing, they got pretty, I'd say fairly close. They predicted 1,270,000 new homes would be built. Actual was 1,160,000. And John, this is one, I don't care if you're looking at the Fed, if you're looking at blue chip forecasters, if you're looking at Wall Street economists, they consistently get the GDP numbers. It's probably been one of the more difficult recoveries that we've seen in a long time, because they forecast 2.5% on GDP, which was roughly sort of where it was in, if you take a look at 2015, the GDP was one of the best years of the Obama administration. outside of 2010. In 2010, GDP grew at 2.5%. In 2015, it grew at 2.6%. So forecasters were saying, well, the Fed's raising interest rates will knock that down a notch. They were predicting 2.5%. Actual growth of GDP was 1.7%. So it's one thing that we have seen, and we've talked about it here on the program, including where the Fed constantly always had to back away from what they predicted at the beginning of the year. Now, they're predicting this year they're going to raise rates three times. You know, that is really, I don't think they're going to get that far. But predicting where the economy is going in this recovery has been so back and forth. It's been so unpredictable. I mean, in 2009, we were in a recession. We came out of that recession in the summer of 2009. The economy was actually down 2.8% that year. 2010, given the QE1, almost $1 trillion stimulus with the Obama administration, the economy grew at 2.5%. But 2011, we fell down to 1.6%. Back up to 2.2 in 2012, 1.7% in 2013. Back up to 2.4 in 2014, 2.6 in 2015, and actually getting down to 1.7%.
And that was a pattern, which you and I commented on frequently here, is that you would see the economy heat up maybe in the second and the third quarter, and then all of a sudden it would take a nosedive in the fourth quarter and into the first quarter of the following year. And we actually saw that in 2016.
Yeah, you know, what was really amazing is that if you take a look at what was going on here, in the first half of 2016, the majority of economic indicators pointed to actually a possible recession in the not too distant future. The stock market was down 10% in the first 6 weeks of the year. We saw a definite slowdown in job creation. We had falling corporate profits for almost 6 quarters in a row. The manufacturing, the ISM manufacturing index dropped below 50 and began to contract. We saw a stalling of temporary hired workers and decelerating car sales, which was interesting because leading into 2015, a lot of these factors were carried over towards the end of 2015, which was actually probably the best year of the Obama presidency in terms of economic growth. So all of that, I mean, you think about it, the stock market down 10% in the first 6 weeks of the year. And then all of a sudden, John, it just flipped around, including our own PFS recession indicator. The stock market ended up with double-digit gains. Job market accelerated beginning in October, November. Temp agency hiring began again. Industrial production was actually up 0.6% in November, year over year. Car sales really didn't increase, but they sort of remained flat, which is interesting because this year, several car manufacturers from GM to Ford are now idling car plant production in the United States. But most pronounced, which could be changing with the Trump administration, business investment pulled back in 2016. And that was one of the things that really threw off economic forecasts. They were counting on, hey, 2016 would be the year that business would start to spend money. That actually didn't happen. Business contracted. And the other thing that we also saw was that we had 6 quarters of profit contraction for the major S&P 500 companies and Dow companies. In Q3, actually profits are up 4.3%. And I know we have something called the PFS recession indicator, and we were watching this thing, and it got up in September, actually went over above 20. Now, anytime our recession indicator gets to 20, we take notice of it, because the last time it got that high was in parts of 2011 and 2012, which was also, if you remember, 2011 was a drop in economic activity along with 2012. And John, it went from September above 20 to currently it's at 5.5. So we have seen a dramatic turnaround in terms of recession probabilities. And that was also reflected in a lot of things that we saw with a lot of the GDP forecast and recession indicators going into 2017.
So the subject here is obviously the consensus forecast for the year. Let us take a look at 2017, because you have to recognize that most of the time when people are running a confluent forecast, you know, parallel trends, and then trying to say where we're going to be, it's pretty much a linear continuation, just an extrapolation from where we currently are going on forward. And of course, it's the rogue events, the black swans, that completely throw these into a tailspin. But let's look at where things are standing right now.
All right, for 2017, and I'm going to give you 2018 because the forecasters are saying, okay, we think we're in a trend here. A lot of these trends are going to carry over into 2018 as a result of the Trump presidency. The official GDP forecast for 2017, now remember, we ended up last year at 1.7%. The official forecast for 2017 is 2.2%. For economic growth, 2.3% for 2018. The unemployment rate, which is at 4.7 currently, it went up in the month of December. The unemployment rate is 4.5% forecasted. It's expected to drop another tenth of a point to 4.4% in 2018. Now, here's a key one, and this is going to play into some of the wild cards in terms of what the Fed's going to do this year. But CPI, which has been trending up now, is expected to come in at 2.3%, which would be slightly above the Fed's target. That would increase to 2.4% in 2018. Now, here's an interesting one. The Fed funds rate right now is at 0.75%. Economists are forecasting the Fed funds rate at 1.3, which would basically be 2 rate hikes instead of 3. I think that's probably more likely. For 2018, they're anticipating 3 rate hikes, a little over 3 rate hikes, because they're forecasting a Fed funds rate, and remember, these are averages, of 2.09. The 10-year note, which has fallen down into the 2.3 range, is forecasted to end the year at roughly 2.9% and roughly at 3.4% in 2018. So they obviously see an upward trajectory in interest rates. Home prices are expected to rise by 4.4% this year and 3.7%. That's going to be good news for homeowners if that takes place, because home prices are up a little over 5% for 2016. Housing starts are expected to come in at 1.26, roughly where they forecasted the year before, and up 1.33 in 2018. So the economists are basically saying that they don't see anything that is going to throw the economy into a recession, at least for the next 2 years, and which is amazing, because we have had, if you take a look at the Obama years, you would have a year of stimulus, the economy would grow. Once again, 2010, 2.5% was the best year outside of 2015, where we grew at 2.6. But anytime we would have a year where we'd grow at, let's say, 2.5%, it was never consistent. We grew at 2.5% in 2010. The following year, we were down almost by a full percentage point. We had a little over 2% in 2012. 2013, we dipped down below 2%. So we've had, let me see, 1, 2, 3 years out of the Obama 8 years where economic growth, despite stimulus, was actually below 2%.
So given all of this, could we say that economists are, what, cautious because of a lot of the downside risk? They were very much that way at the beginning of 2016.
Actually, for the first time, John, economists' view of 2017, the greater problem is there's risk to the upside instead of risk to the downside. They're saying that actually productivity could actually come in higher. They're saying that economic growth, if done right, could come in higher. So they're saying, hey, we may be too conservative here with our number of 2.2. We may get 2.5 or 2.6 or some other number. 64% of the economists polled say that there is growth side risk to the upside, which has been the reversal of their forecast for the last 2 years. Now, like anything else done in forecasting, there's always the caveats. They're saying that these fiscal stimulus policies and deregulation, which are going to be the two key things of Trump, his presidency, especially in the first year, and this is a guy, whether you like him or not, this is a doer. This guy's been doing things from the day he got elected. But they say policy changes, if done right, could boost growth substantially, especially on the regulatory front, which has just been killing economic growth. They're also talking about tax cuts coming to business and individuals. I mean, folks, what do you do when your tax rates are cut? That means more money in your pocket. Now, what do you do with it? Do you save it? Do you spend it? Do you invest it? And I think a lot of the corporate tax cuts, especially if Trump talks about repatriation of profits, a one-time tax of 10% or 15%, whatever number they agree on between the Republican and, let's say, the Trump plan, that money's going to come back. And if it does, it's going to be either spent on capital equipment and investment. It's going to be spent on increasing dividends. It's going to be spent on buying back stocks. So they're saying a lot of these things could be very good for the economy, and also major infrastructure spending. And there's talk that he may do something novel. In other words, instead of financing it strictly with government spending, he may partner with private industry, given the number of smart people he's got in his cabinet, where you keep hearing talk about something called Build America bonds. So I guess the one caveat here is, if this is done correctly, if it's implemented correctly, then actually there could be risk to the upside that the economy grows much faster than is currently projected. So this is a big, major turnaround and forecast that we have seen, John, for the last 2 years. This year, they're finally saying, hey, the risk that we're making right now is we may be too conservative.
But if we go to the what we would call the chief forecaster, meaning the Federal Reserve, if we listen to Chair Janet Yellen, we'll notice that there was an element of uncertainty here.
Of course, the economic outlook is highly uncertain, and participants will adjust their assessments of the appropriate path for the federal funds rate in response to changes to the economic outlook and associated risks. As many observers have noted, changes in fiscal policy or other economic policies could potentially affect the economic outlook. Of course, it is far too early to know how these policies will unfold. Moreover, changes in fiscal policy are only one of the many factors that can influence the outlook and the appropriate course of monetary policy.
And then another theme that Chair Yellen stressed here was the possibility of 3 rate increases in this year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Harriet Torrey with the Wall Street Journal. Why does the Fed now see 3 rate increases next year instead of 2? Is it because the economy is at risk of overheating, or is the Fed behind the curve, or is this a reaction to Donald Trump's election?
Well, I would like to emphasize that this is a very modest adjustment in the path of the federal funds rate, and involves changes by only, you know, some of the participants. So in thinking about the paths and the revisions, there are a number of factors that were taken into account by participants. The unemployment rate is perhaps a touch lower than previously. You've seen some modest downward revisions in that projection. For this year, there was a slight upward revision to inflation. And some of the participants, but not all of the participants, did incorporate some assumption of a change in fiscal policy into their projections. And that may have been a factor that was one of several that occasioned these shifts. But I want to emphasize that the shifts that you see here are really very tiny.
I think the one lesson that we can pick from all of this is that when they make forecasts about whether they're going to taper or not, raise or not, or if they're going to raise, how many times they raise versus what actually happens, the forecasts are revised.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, well, they've done that for almost every single year, whether they were going to taper, whether they were not going to taper, continue to taper. And that's been a very characteristic of this economic recovery. And John, unless we really get this economy surprising dramatically to the upside, in other words, the stimulus is done right, they get it in place in advance, it doesn't take a long time to implement, probably maybe 2 hikes, maybe 1 by summer, and maybe one towards the end of the year. But I just don't see them being very aggressive because, you know, they may come into the crosshairs of the president himself. And that is something, and you remember, we've had a Republican Congress that has wanted to audit the Fed, and they've tried to postpone that, and they were able to do that under Obama. Now, whether they get into upsetting the president's plan to stimulate the economy, one could question if they could come under criticism. Also, there's some vacancies at the Fed that the president-elect is going to fill once he assumes office.
So the forecast generally is for high economic growth in 2017. Obviously, we have a Trump euphoria going here. Now for the stock market, you have to recognize that the majority of people got it wrong in 2016.
Now, this one's interesting, and especially given the movement of the stock market for last year with double-digit gains for the Dow and the S&P. Now, these are prominent Wall Street forecasters, and of course, they take the average. On the high side is the S&P will hit 2,500. That's coming from RBC. That would be a total return of over 10% for the year. The low side is Fundstat, and that is 2,275. You know, that's basically about a 0.5% rate of return. That's probably the most bearish. That isn't too far above where the S&P ended up the year, which was at 2,262. The mean is 2,362. And that would be a gain of little over 4.4%. The median is 2,350, which would be a gain roughly of 3.9%. Now, to me, what's really remarkable about this, despite the 2016 returns, this is the most bearish Wall Street has been on equities since 2005, because 2005 was a year that given all of the things that were going on in the mortgage market, the stock market was booming, oil prices were hitting record levels, gold prices were hitting record levels, Wall Street turned bearish on the market in 2005. The only problem, they were right, but they were just 2 years ahead of the actual bear market. When we got to the actual bear market in September 2007, when the S&P peaked, forecasters were very bullish at that time. So the forecast is the first time we've seen less than a 5% return for the market, which goes back to 2005 when our forecasters were predicting only a 2.8% rise for the market that year.
Yeah, what's causing the bearishness then?
I think there's a couple things. Number one, the surprise coming from the Fed in the December FOMC meeting where they hiked rates, but they said, oh, by the way, we're changing our forecast for 2017. We see us raising interest rates three times. So anytime the Fed changes a forecast like that, hawkishness on the Fed, rising yields, which we saw start from the lows hit in the summer. And remember, we ended up the end of the year at 2.44, but in the middle of December, we actually got to 2.6%. So rising yields, a hawkish Fed, and also a rising dollar. Now, remember, folks, most of the companies that are in the S&P 500 are multinational corporations. So when you sell something in euros, you sell something in yen, and the yen and the euro goes down against the dollar, that means when you translate your European sales back into dollars, you lose money. You make less money. And so a rising dollar would not be good for corporate profits. And the rising dollar would be supported by the Fed aggressively raising interest rates. Remember, the Fed is the only significant central bank at this time that is going in the opposite direction of what the ECB, the Bank of Japan, and the Bank of China are doing. They're still queued into quantitative easing, including the Bank of England. And here our Fed is going in the opposite direction. So anytime the world's largest central bank and most significant central bank does something, it does have an impact on policies around the rest of the world. I mean, the United States is a safe haven, but it also is one of those places in the globe that you can get the highest return on your money when it comes to interest rates. But as we have seen in the past, bull markets usually end when everybody is euphoric. And that is certainly not where we are today. And that's why, I guess, if you're a contrarian, you would bet, you know, my own view, and we'll get to this next week, is we see neither forecast. Either it's going to be down more than anybody ever anticipated, or it's going to be another surprise year to the upside. I just don't see it coming in at a measly 3-4%, as the consensus forecast is. And the other thing you have to bear in mind, all recessions have been caused by Fed tightening. So if the president is trying to stimulate the economy, create more jobs, get manufacturing going here, and the Fed is saying and starts getting overly hawkish, look for a clash between the president and the Fed. But right now, that's, John, I would say that's one of the main reasons they are so bearish, because of that.
Well, I know you've looked at a lot of the forecasts and the investment reports. What are you seeing in what you're reading?
You know, John, they're almost all over the place. I read 25 forecasts from major investment firms. And, you know, there is a little subtle caution, I think, in everybody. And I think that's mainly due to valuations. For example, Goldman Sachs, they were talking about their concerns, high U.S. equity valuations, uncertain economic and political policy prospects, heightened geopolitical risk. But among other reasons, they say, well, you still have to be invested in U.S. equities, because they're talking about the 8-year U.S. preeminence theme is intact and continues in its 9th year. And as they quote Professor Jeremy Siegel from the University of Pennsylvania, who wrote 23 years ago in his Stocks for the Long Run, stocks are the best long run asset. They also think that the policy backdrop in the U.S. will be particularly favorable for the economy, with looser fiscal policy and relatively easy monetary policy. Although Goldman Sachs's forecast, Dave Kostin, was at 2,300, not much above 2,262 at the end of the year. So he's more on the conservative side. Goldman expects global growth to improve modestly from 2.5% to 2.9%. As a result of this fiscal policy. And last but not least, they say, we expect, while President-elect Trump's initial policy measures with respect to tariffs and trade agreements risk jolting the financial markets, as a self-described dealmaker, he will likely adjust and change course as necessary to achieve his desired results. In the end, we may have a bumpy ride, but the U.S. economy will not be derailed. So overall, still a positive bent with some caveats of caution. Bank of America, Michael Hartnett, he's calling 2017 the Icarious Trade. And he's saying after a January and February wobble, which is what we've been seeing with the Dow, we believe stocks and commodities will have at least one last 10% melt up in the first half of the year. And then we wait unambiguous signs of a bullish investor positioning and hawkish Fed policy as well. And they will be calling for, guess what? The big short. The laggard risk trades, global small cap stocks. And they're saying that whenever you start getting these upward increases in Fed hikes, after a while, you get a downturn. We take a look at JP Morgan. They are very positive on global equities, negative for fixed income, reflecting rising interest rates. Interest rates should rise in 2017, but only at a modest pace due to sluggish global growth and very cautious global central banks. Investors want to be long credit in short duration. What they're saying is, look, if you're going to be in the bond market, you want to be short term. So they think stocks could be the big winner. But they think any rise in interest rates would not derail any stock market gains for the year. Northern Trust, normally a very conservative outfit, they are saying global economy is gaining momentum, and their theme for 2017 is upward bound. They think economy is gaining momentum, and U.S. government policy is set to take some load off the Federal Reserve, which leads them to believe that a further increase our recommended exposure to equities and natural resources at the expense of fixed income. So they're saying the place to be is stocks, and the place not to be is in bonds. They expect the Fed will raise interest rates 2 times in 2017, and they're seeing inflation heating up. The folks at PIMCO are fairly conservative in their outlook for the year, seeing a possibility of a regime shift. If the right set of policies get implemented, there's that caveat, once again, coming from economists, of upside risk. If the right things are done in the right way, we could get things improve. They see increased risk that the Fed will step up the pace of rate hikes compared with market expectations. So if things start to heat up in inflation, economic growth, they're saying the surprise the market's not expecting, which is what the Bank of America thinks, is a hawkish Fed increasing rates three or four times, and that's something the market is not expecting. We have the folks at BlackRock, which think that the global growth expectations, they expect that to pick up, and they think it's going to be another good year for the market. The folks at Legg Mason, their key theme, what could go right in 2017? So they're saying there's all kinds of things here, if done in the right way, could propel growth, profit margins, and everything else forward. A very positive outlook coming from the folks at Legg Mason. State Street Bank, they say their forecast, the place to be, unlike my guest Frank Holmes in the first hour, they're saying large cap equities are the place for the upside. They want to weight overweight U.S. equities. They're saying the place to be is the U.S. stock market, underweight international equities. They're neutral on emerging markets, neutral on government bonds, overweight high yield, overweight commodities, and they favor value over quality. So overall, as you can see there, some cautious optimism to all the way, hey, go for it. This is the year. But the one overall consensus coming from all these firms is the place to be is still going to be equities versus bonds, given the fact that we have now entered into a Fed rate raising cycle. So rather interesting coming out of these firms.
Okay, well, there we are. The consensus outlook, positive pretty much for the year, about what, a 4% gain, would we say, in the economy, something along those ideas. Let's do what we do second as part of our first weekend of the year, and that is look at those people who are thinking outside of the box.
And at the top of the list, we always cover Byron Wayne. And it was interesting because he was interviewed in Barron's on January 3rd. And he said, you know, my practice of reviewing the 10 surprises of the year, last year's list was on the way to being one of the best. And then Donald Trump got elected and everything changed. And, you know, what he's trying to do, a lot of people say, how does he come up with this? He goes, every year, there are a number of unexpected events that influence the financial markets, and 2016 was a good example. Very few people expected Donald Trump to be elected, and Byron Wayne, he goes, I certainly didn't. He was predicting Hillary Clinton. I define as a surprise an event that has an average professional investor would only assign a 1 in 3 chance of taking place, but I believe it's probable, meaning that it has a better than 50% chance of happening during the year. Usually I get 5 or 6 of these right. And he was saying he was on track to get almost like 7 or 8 of them right. And then Donald Trump got elected. And so anyway, he's got his list of 10 surprises for the year. Now, the purpose of doing these kind of things is to think outside the box. Just like last year, the results of Brexit and the U.S. presidential election took everybody by surprise. These are the kind of one-off events or special events that happen. Call them a black swan, white swan, whatever you want to call them. They're events that happen that nobody expects that could alter the outcome. So here we go with number one. Still brooding about his loss of the popular vote, Donald Trump vows to win over those who oppose him by 2020. He moves away from his more extreme positions on virtually all issues to the dismay of some right-wing loyalist. He insists the voters elected me, not my ideology. His unilateral actions throw policy staffers throughout the government into turmoil. Virtually all the treaties and agreements he vowed to tear up on his first day in office are modified, not trashed. His waste paper basket remains empty. Number two prediction, the combination of tax cuts on corporations and individuals, more constructive trade agreements, dismantling the regulation of the financial and energy companies, infrastructure tax incentives pushed the 2017 growth rate above 3%. Productivity improves for the first time since 2014. Prediction number three, The Standard & Poor's operating earnings are 130 in 2017, and Byron Wien is right up there with RBC. He sees the S&P 500 hitting 2,500 as investors become convinced the U.S. economy is back on a long-term growth path after being 8 years in the wilderness. Number four, macro investors make a killing on currency fluctuations. The Japanese yen goes to 130 against the dollar, stimulating exports. As Brexit moves closer, the British pound declines to $1.10. Number five, increased economic growth. Inflation moves towards 3%. A renewed demand for capital push interest rates higher across the board. The 10-year yield approaches 4%. Now, that'd be an interesting one to see a 4% yield on a 10-year note in a 2,500 level on the S&P. Surprise number six, populism spreads over Europe, affecting the elections in France and Germany. Angela Merkel loses the vote in October. Across the European electorate, questions the usefulness of the European Union. Surprise number seven, reduced regulations in the energy industry leads to a surge in production in the U.S. Iran and Iraq step up their output. The increased supply keeps the price of West Texas Intermediate below $60 for most of the year. Number eight, Donald Trump realized he has long been wrong on China. Its currency is overvalued, not undervalued, and depreciates to 8 to the dollar. Its economy flourishes on consumer spending on goods produced at home and greater exports. Surprise number nine, benefiting from stronger growth in China and the United States, real growth in Japan exceeds 2% for the first time in decades, and its stock market leads overall developed countries in appreciation for the year. So even though he's predicting the S&P could be up 10%, things could be better in Japan. Number 10, the Middle East cools down. Donald Trump and his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, working with Vladimir Putin, finally negotiate a lasting ceasefire in Syria. ISIS diminished significantly as a Middle East threat, and Bashar al-Assad remains in power.
So here are Byron Wien's predictions for the year. First of all, we'll look at market predictions.
You also think that the hot spots like the Middle East will cool down. I mean, it sounds overall, when you read all of these surprises, economic growth will be better, Donald Trump will be sort of softer, populism will spread. It could be a very good year next. I mean, when you look at the market,
I have the market at 2,500. I have the market going up to another 10%.
So there he has market predicted to hit 2,500. And then if we take a look at Trump, will he be softer than everyone is fearful of?
The big political surprise is that Trump isn't as extreme as he appeared in the campaign, and that he softens his stance on almost everything. Particularly on domestic policy, that he focuses on his growth agenda. He concentrates on reducing taxes, dismantling regulation, and spending money on infrastructure. And as a result, the market does well, the economy does well, corporate earnings do well.
So there are Byron Wien's forecasts for the coming year. And let me guess, Doug Cass is going to be the one we're going to look at next.
Not really for this year. His forecasts have been so off. They've just been terrible. So what we're going to do is we're going to go with top 10 themes and trades for 2017 as issued by Goldman Sachs. And we're just going to go through these very briefly. Number one, expect returns only slightly higher. And this gets back to Goldman Sachs' Dave Kostin, who thinks that, you know, we'll only hit roughly about 2,300 on the S&P, which is not too much above where it ended the year at 2,262. Number two, U.S. fiscal policy will be a pro-growth agenda. Number three, U.S. trade policy concerns are likely overdone. This is sort of matching what Byron Wien is saying. Hey, all this stuff, he's going to do this to China and all that. Watch, he'll probably back away because he's a pragmatist. Number four, EM risk. Trump tantrum is temporary. So they don't expect big trade brouhaha brewing between, let's say, Trump and our trading partners. Number five, Trump and trade hedge with RMB. Number six, monetary policy focusing the toolkit on credit creation rather than interest rates. Number seven, corporate revenue growth recession, signs of an inflection. Maybe that could turn around with an increased economy. Eight, inflation moving higher across developed markets from here to Europe. Actually, there was a report in the Wall Street Journal on Thursday that German inflation has been hitting above 2% for the first time. Number nine, the next credit cycle will be kinder and gentler. And number 10, the Yellen call 2.0, now with a contingent knock-in, so maybe not as bad as people think. So that was Goldman Sachs. And what I want to cover next is Saxo Bank. They tend to be more on sort of really get you thinking outside the box. And they have what they call their outrageous predictions, and they're usually off the wall.
You know, it's interesting. I've talked about the great reneging because politicians say a lot of things during the campaign trail and then change a bit once they're confronted with some of the reality. I think Byron Wien views Mr. Trump as being a pragmatist. And so while he's forceful, at least speaking forcefully in certain areas, may moderate some of these views or actions once other considerations come into play and he gets involved with it. So on our category list here of who's outside the box, who's next?
Next is Saxo Bank. They publish every single year 10 outrageous predictions. Number one, China's GDP swells to 8% and their stock market hits 5,000. Number two, now this is interesting, a desperate Fed follows the Bank of Japan's lead to fix 10-year treasuries at 1.5%. As the U.S. dollar and U.S. interest rates rise in increasingly painful fashion in 2017, the testosterone-driven fiscal policy of the new president leads U.S. 10-year yields to reach 3%, causing market panic. On the verge of disaster, the Fed Reserve copies the Bank of Japan's yield curve control by fixing the 10-year government yield at 1.5% from a different angle, effectively introducing, get ready for this one, QE4 or QE endless. Boy, that would be a switch. Number three, high yield default rates exceed 25%, with the long-term average default rate normally around 4%, jumping during U.S. recessions to 16, 10, and 12% in the past. 2017 sees default rates as high as 25%. Number four, Brexit never happens as the UK remains is the theme for Britain. Number five, Dr. Copper catches a cold. Copper was one of the clear commodity winners of the U.S. election. However, in 2017, the market begins to realize that the new president will struggle to deliver the promised investments and increased demand for copper falls. Number six, huge gains for Bitcoin as cryptocurrencies rise. With the U.S. budget deficit, they're predicting Bitcoin could hit 2,100. Number seven, U.S. healthcare reform triggers sector panic. Healthcare expenditures is 17% of GDP compared to 10% on average. The initial relief rally in healthcare stocks after Trump's victory quickly fades in 2017 as investors realize the administration will not go easy on healthcare. Number eight, despite Trump, Mexico peso soars, especially against the Canadian dollar. Number nine, Canadian banks are the best performing equity asset. Boy, that would be a real big surprise. And number 10, the EU stimulates growth through mutual European bonds. So those are sort of the outside the box type of things that sort of get you thinking and say, could that happen? Maybe. I mean, but take a look, John. 2016, nobody expected Brexit, and least of all, a Trump victory, especially as many electoral votes as he got.
There have got to be some wild cards, too. Just like the Trump election, the Brexit. Anybody anticipating any wild cards for 2017?
Oh, there's plenty of wild cards. And I would say probably at the top of the list, John, is got to be a Fed policy mistake. Because we all know the saying that we have here, anytime the Fed starts a rate raising cycle, they will keep raising interest rates until sooner or later something breaks. And every recession since World War II has been caused by a Fed rate raising cycle. So, you know, will they raise rates too much? I mean, they start out and they're saying, we're going to raise it three times. They upped that in December. And so, you know, this is one of the cautions proposed by PIMCO, that the Fed gets overly hawkish, especially as inflation is now in an uptrend and expected to exceed over 2%, the Fed's target. And so I would say at the top of the list is a monetary mistake by the Federal Reserve. Now, it's interesting because Bloomberg had 10 wild cards. One of them is Russia goes on a warpath. Annexation of the Crimea 2 years ago, Russian military aggression in Eastern Europe remains one of the big risks for 2017. While an actual military invasion is unlikely, the foundations for an invasion may be laid next year. U.S. foreign policy to the election of populist leaders in Europe. Number two, a surge in U.S. productivity. Increased productivity means faster economic growth, and that could lead to, let's say, a more rapid rate rise by the Federal Reserve. Another one, China finally floats the yuan. Now, one of the things to follow here is China's foreign currency reserves have gone from $4 trillion down to $3 trillion, and it's estimated they're below $3 trillion. They've been doing that to maintain the peg. They finally say, hey, it is time to let the currency float freely in the market. Another one, an exit from Brexit. Instead of leaving, the UK Supreme Court might trigger a general election were it to galvanize pro-EU sections of parliament, or the EU could grant the country a face-saving concession. Another wild card, capital controls in emerging markets, and especially if their currencies start to fall apart with a rising dollar. Another surprise, Japan's inflation finally jumps, crossing over 2% for the first time, forcing the Bank of Japan to take action by lifting its 10-year target of 0%. Another wild card, these clearinghouses are basically the stock exchanges. There is a clearinghouse crisis somewhere in the developed world. Another wild card, Trump takes the fight to the Fed. The Fed chair has indicated she'll stay for the term, yet Janet Yellen was on the receiving end of some harsh invective during the future president's campaign. More likely, they believe, is that Trump will name sympathetic board members when the present appointments expire. Next surprise, Abenomics comes unstuck. Abe's support will be solidified. Anything fracturing that view could come as a shock to the Japanese system. And one, they say, the end of cash. It seems inevitable that electronic payments will replace notes and coin at some point, but it might happen sooner rather than later. Negative yields, electronic money could prevent potential savers stashing money under the mattress. In other words, if they can't get the economy going with fiscal stimulus or anything else, in order to prevent savers from actually saving money, they would actually get rid of cash and go to electronic money, so you wouldn't be able to do it. Now, some of the things that are also out there, I would say the big unknowns, just like anything else, are geopolitical risk, especially risk between U.S. and China. They've been deteriorating, contrary to the current views by the press. They've been deteriorating substantially over the last couple of years, especially with what's going on in the South China Sea. Also, the defeat of ISIS could create a diaspora. So the defeat of ISIS could actually create a power vacuum in the Middle East, a diaspora of terrorism as terrorists spread out and flame all over the globe. And also, there could be a coming conflict between Turkey, the Kurds, Iran, and Russia. So I would say on the geopolitical front, those are the ones that are always most difficult to predict. You know, some kind of financial event, the Fed getting super hawkish, those are a little bit more to predict. It's the geopolitical things like what Russia did 2 years ago, or for example, what's going on in Syria today. But overall, people are pretty optimistic. In fact, Chris Sheridan on the Financial Sense Insider did an extensive interview with Martin Armstrong that will be played on FS Insider Wednesday, January 18th. And here's a clip of that interview that we're going to play right now.
What you have to understand about the stock market is that this is not just an isolated issue. You have capital trying to flee China. and money just pouring out of there to everywhere under the sun. You have Europe basically in a basket case situation, and you have big money, it just has to park. And so it's been parking primarily in the Dow. And we have three indexes here, and you have to understand who uses what. The big money looks at the Dow. All right. Then you have the domestic, more professional fund management, et cetera, looking at the S&P. And the NASDAQ tends to be more retail oriented. So all these people that have been predicting a crash in the stock market, they basically just off a chart pattern. And but they don't look at what's happening behind it. No way do we have a bubble. You don't have retail participation in the market at record highs. It's closer to the record lows. People haven't come back since they lost a lot of money in 2007. So our model is basically showing the next resistance area is this 21 to 23 area, which can be achieved without a lot of problem. Once you pop through the 20 psychological number, you'll get a bit of a lift, but you're still probably not going to draw in all the retail speculation yet. That will come in once you get through 23. When you start getting through that, then they're going to say, all these people are wrong, and they're just going to start jumping in.
You know, it's interesting, Jim, because we've talked a lot about here on the show that the public really isn't participating in the market. And if you look at Martin Armstrong's predictions, he really has some solid basis to some of the things that he's saying.
Well, certainly. I mean, if you look at this bull market, $1.9 trillion has gone into bond funds by individual investors since 2009 and virtually zero net into the stock market. And that's just, John, that's just not the way bull markets end. We alluded to earlier in this program that strategists have not been this cautious and negative since 2005 when they predicted 2.8% gains for the market that year. They were actually 2 years ahead of the actual peak of the market. But by the time we got to September of 2007, the S&P was back to its old highs and everybody was euphoric. And that's exactly when the bull market ended. And so usually they end in euphoria, and that's certainly not what we have today. So that's why I think, and we'll get into this next week when we do a surprise interview for our forecast for 2017 and also our own views as we'll express, and we'll do that next week as we continue forecast 2017, the year of the oracles.
Well, Jim, that concludes our what we call the consensus prediction program. It's actually consensus and then some of the people who are outliers and some of their ideas, people thinking outside the box. Next week, we're going to look at our predictions, I guess.
We're going to look at our predictions and a couple things coming up next week. Of course, next Friday will be the inauguration of Donald Trump as the 45th president of the United States. All kinds of things going on next week. And as a result of that, of course, we got cabinet hearings going on. The left is planning mass demonstrations. So who knows, maybe we get a little bit of civil unrest or some kind of event. And then we also have a Fed meeting coming up. So it'll be their first of the year. So it'll be interesting to see if they hint that they're going to go ahead and raise rates in March. If they are, they're going to want to prep the markets for that because they would do that in the January meeting this month, and they would also do that next month when Janet Yellen is up on Capitol Hill. Now, remember, it was a pivot point and an inflection point for the markets last year at this time because the markets went down straight 6 weeks in a row. Everything was plunging, and all of a sudden, Janet Yellen gets on Capitol Hill. Well, maybe that 4 rate hikes this year, we're going to have to pull that back. And then, of course, Japan also instigated negative interest rates, and then it was up and away from that point forward. So all of that is coming up in the weeks ahead. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for tuning into our forecast issue, our first program of the year. We hope that 2017 finds you happy, healthy, and prosperous. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.